Good afternoon, everybody. How you doing? Thank you all for coming. I'm Eli Nyberger. I'm the Associate Director of IT and Production at the Ann Arbor District Library. We'd just like to thank you all so much for coming to this event today. This is the final event of our series commemorating this amazing event that happened 40 years ago today. We want to make sure that you all have an opportunity to visit freeingjohnsinclair.org, which is the online website of this product. We've digitized the whole Ann Arbor Sun. We've got numerous interviews with almost everybody on stage, as well as a bunch of people who aren't here yet, as well as numerous documents from the period and photographs. So it's a really great resource. We hope you all check that out. Those of you who didn't attend the event last night at the Arc, we have more of the wristbands that were given out, which are precious mementos for sure. eBay will surely be hopping. So if you feel free to help yourself to them over there. We also have a couple free copies of the book about the Del Rio, which is a very interesting work as well. So please take a look at that. Before we get started, I just want to take one moment to thank two people who have been very instrumental in this project. It's my unique opportunity and pleasure to call myself these people's boss. And Amy Cantu and Andrew McLaren are the librarians who pulled this entire project together in the back of the room. And they are truly showing what the future of librarianship is. It's not your mother's librarian, it's not even your librarian, it's your grandchildren's librarian. So thank you, Amy and Andrew, for all your hard work on that. And with that, it is my pleasure to introduce the moderator for today's event, and that's Dr. Bruce Conforth. He was raised in New York City's Greenwich Village, where he was part of both the folk scene of the early 1960s and the countercultural rock-based scene that emerged in the middle of that decade. Touring with a blues-based rock and roll band until the late 70s, he returned to academia, earning his PhD in ethnomusicology and American and Afro-American studies from Indiana University. He was the founding curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum and is now a faculty member in the University of Michigan's program in American culture. So please join me in welcoming our moderator today, Bruce Conforth.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I don't usually use notes, but today I wanted to make sure that I got things exactly the way that I wanted to say them, because this has been 40 years in the making. You know, the title for this whole undertaking was Freeing John Sinclair, The Day the Legends Came to Town. But I would contend that the legends didn't have to come to town because they were already here. Go ahead, applaud. I think it's true.
That was an applause line.
That's right. That's right. You know, in real estate, if there's such a thing anymore, they say, you know, it's all about location, location, location. And as I tell my students, it's always all about context, context, context. And personally, I don't really think that any particular event, no concert, no happening, ever really defines a generation. But rather, those are just manifestations of the larger cultural context that made those events possible. And just like I don't think Woodstock defined either a generation or hippies at that particular moment, but rather was made possible by the context of those times, neither did, I think, the Free John Sinclair concert define a particular generation or everything that was happening in Ann Arbor and Detroit. Certainly, the legends representing some countercultural, counterpolitical, and musical undertakings did come to town, but I think the real legends, as I said, were already here, because they were the people who helped create the context that enabled such an event to take place. So it's my pleasure to host this event and to share the stage with these individuals who might balk, although I'm not sure about some of them, John, they might balk about being called legends, but without whom none of the events that took place that 40 years ago would have been possible. So it's now my pleasure to introduce to my left, Pun Plamondon. Plamondon. I knew I was going to screw it up. Plamondon.
It's a hard one.
Who is a. Yeah. Pun is a member of the Grand River Bands of Ottawa. He is an author, playwright, native storyteller, and activist. He is president pro tem of CUR, Congress of Unrepentant Radicals. He was co-founder and minister of defense of the White Panther and Rainbow People's Parties, and lives quietly on a farm in the Ottawa ceded territories of Michigan, where he tries to avoid difficult tasks. To his left is David Fenton. In the 1960s, David dropped out of high school, ran away from home, and went to work for the Liberation News Service, where he supported himself as a photographer. While in Ann Arbor, he worked with the White Panthers and Rainbow People's Party on their underground newspaper, the Ann Arbor Sun, which later moved to Detroit and became the Detroit Sun. After leaving Michigan, he spent time directing public relations for Rolling Stone, then entered the activist fray in the anti-nuclear movement of the late 1970s, co-producing in 1979 the No Nukes concerts headlined by Bruce Springsteen and Bonnie Raitt. From there, he went on to found his own activism-centered PR company, Fenton Communications. And in 1982, he's turned leftist activism into big business, working with groups such as Center for Food Safety, Greenpeace, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and MoveOn.org.
It's all your fault.
To David's left is Lenny Sinclair. Few artists have captured the spirit of the 60s, as did photographer Lenny Sinclair. Lenny brought a camera with her when she emigrated here from Germany in 1959 and soon found her way to the Wayne State University's nascent alternative cultural environs. She met future husband John in the early 1960s at such Detroit venues as the Red Dog Gallery. Together with John, jazz trumpeter Charles Moore, experimental filmmaker Robin Eichel, and others, she helped found the Detroit Artists Workshop in November 1964. As I mentioned, Lenny was on hand to document some of the most important cultural scenes of the 60s. During those proto-unto-revolutionary and legendary 1960s music and cultural explosions in Detroit, Lenny documented political events, the White Panther Party, music from individuals like Sun Ra to John Coltrane, from the MC5 and Iggy Pop to Jimi Hendrix, creating iconic images that now place her as one of the foremost visual documentarians of that era. To Lenny's left is Jeannie Parker. In the 1960s, Jeannie fell in with Trans Love Energies Unlimited, headed up by John and Lenny and Gary Grimshaw in Detroit, moving with them in 1968 to Ann Arbor, where she became active in the White Panther Party as Minister of International Affairs. She even visited North Vietnam as part of her responsibilities in that regard. And became very active with the Rainbow People's Party. She ran for Ann Arbor City Council as a Human Rights Party candidate in 1972 and now teaches Tai Chi. And of course, to her left and last but not least is John Sinclair. You know, I've known John since 1968, and I thought, you know, how do I say anything about this man?
Short.
Well, it's tough to be short. John attended Flint College of the University of Michigan, now the University of Michigan Flint. At that time, he served on the university's publications board, the school newspaper, The Word, and was president of the Cinema Guild. He was also involved in the reorganization of the Detroit Underground newspaper, the Fifth Estate, during the paper's growth in the late 1960s. He He contributed to the formation of the Detroit Artists Workshop Press, which published 5 issues of Work magazine. He worked as a jazz writer for Downbeat from 1964 to 1965, and was one of the new poets who read at the seminal Berkeley Poetry Conference in July 1965. He was, of course, manager for a time of the band the MC5 and was co-founder and leader of the White Panther Party. Under his guidance, the MC5 embraced the counterculture revolutionary politics of the White Panther Party, founded in answer to the Black Panthers' call for white people to support their movement. It was during this period that the group became the regular house band at Detroit's Grandy Ballroom in what came to be known as the Kick Out the Jams shows. In 1969, John was famously or infamously sentenced to 10 years in prison for possession of 2 marijuana joints, thereby becoming a cause célèbre in the countercultural scene. This was, of course, what prompted the Free John Sinclair concert at Chrysler Arena exactly 40 years ago today on December 10th, 1971, bringing together such diverse artists as John Lennon and Yoko Ono, folk singers and activists Phil Oakes and Pete Seeger, local groups The Up, Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airmen, Bob Seeger, other artists like Stevie Wonder, jazz legend Archie Shepp, and speakers Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers, Jerry Rubin, Allen Ginsberg, Rennie Davis, and many others. John was released from prison 3 days after the concert was held. Yes, Wayne Kramer is in the house. Indeed. So, you know, I think one of the places that I'd like to start, see where you go from here, is to hearken back to March 1st, 1968, the March 1st, 1968 issue of The Sun. Yeah, oh wow. In which, John, you wrote about the philosophy that the White Panthers and you were putting out at the time, and talked about how
the Panthers didn't exist yet.
Pardon?
Get your dates straight, Professor. There were no White Panthers in the spring of 1968.
But you were still putting together the idea that come out in the open and smoke some dope with us, pass the joint around to your friends. Doesn't it make you feel good? Doesn't it make you
felt that way.
Doesn't it make you want to fuck? Well, then go right ahead, because after all, what we want is fucking in the streets.
Amen.
Why don't we do it in the road?
Yeah.
Why not?
What were you thinking?
Thank you. Does thinking have anything to do with a statement like that? No. We also had an expression at that time called cut your head off, stop thinking, foul your body. That would be part of that rhetoric. So cut your head off, get rid of it. People thinking too much. Thinking was what got them into the war and the whole ugly shit that America has become. All came from white men with a lot of money thinking about how they wanted a perfect world. Now they have it. Do you like it? It's like Frank Zappa said, do you love it? Do you hate it? There it is, the way you made it. Sorry. I don't want to be a wet blanket here, but Jesus Christ, you know. It's 40 years later and it's like a long swirl down the toilet bowl, you know. And we aren't to the bottom yet, but they're getting there. On September 17th, 2011, Americans finally stood up and said, wait a minute, this shit is fucked up. That was 2 months ago. Good start, you know? I hope they don't just shut their eyes and turn the TV back on again, but I'm excited about that now. I don't know, why am I doing all this talk? What did you ask me? See, I figure I look out here and say, it's 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Haven't you people got anything better to do?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. You have to take whatever I say there. You know, Pam told me that last night. I've been dreading this for months. You know, they're going to have a reunion over the Hill Street. You know, I lived there. I was in the, you know, my bed was here, and blah, blah, blah. It was a rough period of ups and downs in many ways, trying to do a lot of things. And I'm thinking, man, to see all these people again, I don't know, they're going to want to beat me up and shit. Pam came up to me last night before I went on stage, and he said, man, these people love us. And I said, wow, come on, really? He says, yeah, man, they had such a great time in those periods, and they forgot all the bad stuff that happened. And I said, oh, wow. So I figured if I get through today without a heart attack, then we won't have to deal with this for at least another 10 more years, because in our contemporary culture, if you don't have a zero on the end, it doesn't exist that year, you know.
Well, how about that?
Maybe I won't even have to live another 10 years. Who knows?
How about that, you know, the rest of the panel? I mean, John, you mentioned, you know, the good times and the bad times.
Shut that nut up.
No, but really, I mean, you know, it wasn't all good times.
Yeah, but I'd trade today for that any time. Except for the penitentiary.
What, you want to hear about bad times?
No, I don't. I want to hear, you know, I think we want to hear about anything you want to talk about, but I think, you know, if we could approach it, you know, if 40 years can lend us anything, maybe it's a little bit of honest perspective. And I think, you know, that would
or
be worth
investigating. Or false perspective, for that matter.
Okay,
here's we've had enough false perspective. That's what we get from the politicians all the time.
Okay, here's the thought.
College does a good job, too. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Here's the thought. If you were not around for the 50s, you have a hard time understanding the 60s.
Yeah.
The 50s was the golden age of the old white men running this country, right?
Kind of like the 80s,
right?
Though.
Well, they're not done yet. They're not done yet. They're not done yet.
No, no, no.
So there were some bad times. I mean, at first, you would walk down the street looking like we look, and you stuck out like a sore thumb. I mean, I look around the room here, and a bunch of us look alike. I mean, we look alike. It was a cultural thing, and I think that's what John was trying to say. At first, it was just a cultural thing. It wasn't political at all. We were into music, clothes, food, drugs, right? entertainment. I mean, our culture was different. And we didn't become politicized until we started getting attacked. And that started on the streets, when we would just walk around looking like we looked. And people would attack us, literally, physically.
Yeah, the myth of the hipness of the campus in the 60s is an enormous myth, because in the 60s, the campus was squares, wall-to-wall squares, football players. It was just, hated hippies. They hated it. That's what I loved about the Occupy thing. When they finally asked the people, they put a poll, what do you think of this? 62% of Americans said, this is a good idea. And I thought, Jesus, when we did this, if we got 6.2% of what they hated us.
Yeah.
They put me in prison for 10 years for two joints. Think about that. How much is that an index of hatred?
And they would still like to do that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, we've got a little ways from that.
Are we getting there?
Yeah. No, I think your point was extremely well made, that the 50s really were the context for what laid late after that.
That's the context.
And your point about, you know, it being a cultural thing at first, I think is very well taken. And you know, there was that moment in time when there were so few of us that you instantly were able to recognize, you know, another person, mm-hmm. because not only did you know that they had something in common with you, but you pretty much knew that they were suffering the same grief that you were suffering too.
Right.
So I mean, it was kind of like, you know, understanding, you know, another victim of war.
You know, Bruce, at the same time though, we were just pure hippies. We were also against the war in Vietnam. Right. We were against the oppression of black people. We were for civil rights and economic justice for everyone, because that's the way hippies were.
And it
so
wasn't...
So hippies, they've kind of erased...
I'm going to interrupt you this time.
Yeah, please.
It wasn't just people attacking us that made us political either, because it was the Black Panther Party, yeah, who really took an interest in us. And I know that that name generates all this fear, and because there was a lot of stuff that was said about them, but when they contacted us, they were very kind to us. They were very considerate, and they were very clear about wanting to help us to understand what was really going on, you know, and to help us to understand how we could actually change things.
Kind of guidance.
Yeah, yeah. Right, no.
They made us read the Red Book.
So now it's your turn again.
No,
we have
no, I think Pong probably has a speech.
Speak.
I mean, I don't say that in a negatory way.
No, I don't take it.
Sorry.
What's the issue?
The bad times and the good times.
Well, I don't know. I didn't have many hard times.
In jail?
No, I did easy time. I wrote about it in my book. When I went to the penitentiary, the warden called me in, and it's kind of like the movies. They make you sit in this chair that they cut the legs off, so your knees are way up like this, and you're looking up at the warden, and he says, Plamondon, we got two kinds of time here. We've got hard time and easy time. What can I put you down for? And I said, easy time, man. And so, I mean, it's a lack-love institution. It's full of violence and rejects from the dominant society. But I always found beauty in those people. And if as long as there is a lower class or a criminal class, I'm in it. I make no bones about it. I don't really remember. I remember getting beat up. I got 100 stitches in Detroit. Some guys tried to castrate me because I was a hippie living in the hippie house. And I got 100 stitches from that. But I mean, that's like, it passes, you know. Everything else, the struggle against the state, the watching young people stand up, believe in something, risk their lives for something so amorphous, so out there, there was no real example on this planet of what we were trying to do, but we had a vision that it could be done. And quite frankly, I'm humbled to my very core to see Wayne Kramer, Diane Ripley, Kathy Kelly. These were youngsters. I was 22, 23 years old. These people were youngsters. Fuzzy sitting back there, 16 years old, he came to us. You know, in those days, there weren't no drug help. There wasn't any homeless shelters. There wasn't any shelters for women who were being abused by husbands. Or many of the runaways were abused at home, and that's why they run away. There were no institutions to address those issues. That's why we had all those runaways stand at our house. That's why the police were kicking in the door all the time looking for some 15-year-old or 16-year-old runaway. So we didn't say, well, I believe there's a need in society, and let's address that need. No, these were just people like us, long hair, crazy clothes, listening to rock and roll, smoking reefer, who didn't have a place to stay. And now, of course, that they've taken those away from us, from the community, and they put them in these institutions. So I'll rest a minute.
So the first time I met John and Pun, they were both in prison. I had never met them. I actually had seen Pun. I saw Pun once at an underground media conference in Ann Arbor. And I remember, Pun, you were guarding the entrance with a gun. And I must have been 17 years old. And we're all sitting around meeting people from the underground newspapers all over the country. And it was in some rural area.
What underground newspaper was?
Oh, an underground newspaper was a hippie, countercultural, anti-war, utopian, psychedelically influenced newspaper. And like, I worked at Liberation News Service before I came out to Ann Arbor, and it was started in part by former Washington Post reporters who were so upset at the biased and horrible coverage of the Vietnam War in the Washington Post that they started their own news service to tell the truth about Vietnam. It's hard to imagine today.
They could use one now.
So anyway, I'm at this conference. I'm 17 years old. I'm sitting in a field with, you know, Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and all these icons of the time. And the next thing I know, there are armed police descending on us from 360 degrees, from everywhere. And I remember people started mysteriously emptying their pockets onto the ground. I mean, it's hard to imagine how tense it was. I went and met John in prison, and I was just a photographer. And I was a kid, I was 18. And all I had ever done is take photographs. And so John said he was gonna start telling me how I was gonna help him get out of prison. And I said, sure. And he started sending me letters from Jackson State Penitentiary, long handwritten legal pad letters with detailed instructions on how to get him out. And that's how I learned public relations.
I don't usually get credit for that.
At Liberation News Service, I covered the Chicago 7 trial. So at that time, I was also late, about 16. And the first time I ever went into an American courtroom was the day they bound and gagged Bobby Seale, a story that most of you know about. And I guess this is the law. So I get these letters from John, and he says, take my wife to the Michigan Supreme Court, tie her hands behind her back, and put a gag in her mouth, and call these reporters. So, you know, between Sinclair and Abby Hoffman, who I was also spending time with, who was a masterful public relations genius, you know, I'm very happy to carry on in the tradition. That's all I can say. But yeah, there were downsides, sure. You know, trying to reinvent how to live in a utopian aspirational community was not all a bed of roses. No. It was hard. We were making stuff up as we went along. People got abusive. There was great emotional stress. You know, we experimented with things that I kind of wish we hadn't. I think politically,
economic struggle also.
Yeah, it was tough.
Surviving
for me as an Upper East Side New York City kid, I have to say it was tough. We had no private property. Imagine. I had to get permission from John's brother to buy a pair of blue jeans. That didn't last too long, thankfully.
$5. They cost $150. They rip because you wore them too long.
So, but I think politically, also there was big plus side. We changed a lot of things in this country. When I say we, I mean the movement of the 60s. You know, the status of women today, the rights of gays, the personal freedom, experimentation, you know, human rights, the end of the draft, you know, it's a different place, thank God, in so many ways. But our excesses, and that's what they were, it's fueled a counter-reaction that we are all saddled with today. It wasn't just us, but, you know, Abby used to walk around chanting, "Off the pig." That was really going to endear him to the, right. And it was appropriate for them. The pigs were offing them. But we engaged in excesses rhetorically and certain behaviors that I think we could have been more thoughtful about. And it helped reelect Nixon, let's face it. And
I resemble that in Rodmire.
And it helped, you know, Newt Gingrich, the conservative movement today. I mean, it would have happened anyway.
You got nothing to do with that motherfucker.
All right, so.
We heard of a beef, but nothing to do with the Nudster.
We can agree to disagree about that. Anyway, it was a great, heady, amazing time, and it's really wonderful to feel a part of it. And, you know, I've been working a little with some of these Occupy Wall Street people as a volunteer, and it's... And it's really interesting to watch them go through some of the same dynamics that we had to face. Like, you know, they're going to have to deal with the anarchists in their midst. That's coming. And, you know, my favorite moment is what I said to a couple of them. You know, you've got the attention of the country. Maybe you should go negotiate with the city for a permanent encampment. And they said, no, we're never going to do that. I said, why? They said, we don't recognize their authority.
Good start.
Well.
I thought they finally found the right target, Wall Street.
Yeah.
Somebody said, yeah, it's quite a symbolic target. I said, what are you? It's also literally where the shit is. They own this whole country. So we don't have a government anymore. They own them all. Like Michael Moore says, until you get rid of the campaign financing, you don't even have a shred of democracy in this country. It's just rich people. I hate them. I always have. I always will. Fuck them.
So Lenny, what was the
world
like for
you? I guess it's all right if you're rich, but if you aren't rich, it's kind of ugly.
When he shuts up, I'll stop talking.
Okay. John?
Now you get into the marital issue.
Lenny, what was it like for you? It was hard, huh?
First of all, before getting into any of it, I just wanted to mention the John Sinclair Freedom Rally was on December 10th. By the way, it's a full moon today. Yeah.
Was it then?
But since you mentioned human rights in your... at the time, in 1971, I don't think any of us knew that December 10th was International Human Rights Day, which was established in 1947 after World War VII. I mean, after World War II, in 1947, and it had the Charter of Human Rights that pretty much mirrors the White Panther Party 10-point program. Human rights. Now, if you put somebody in jail for possession of two joints, isn't that a violation of human rights? I would say, you know,
Amen.
And that's what, you know, we celebrate today is International Human Rights Day.
But you know, speaking of the concert, you know, it wasn't all altruism. You know, I mean, John Lennon had to be convinced by Jerry Rubin to come and do the concert. John didn't want to do the concert initially. And John had his own alternative, you know, reasons for doing it. He had been planning a large tour anyway. He wanted to use the concert as a venue to test out his sound system and his filmmaking equipment. I mean, granted, yes, he did come and do it, and it was a great thing. I'm not trying to slight John. But let's lay our cards on the table. John, let's lay our cards on the table. John did not do it solely for altruistic reasons, and I think a lot. You know, I mean, I was there too.
I didn't go to prison solely for altruistic reasons.
Exactly. And
this is the world, bro.
The point that I'm trying to make is a lot of what we did, like David was saying, you know, we didn't always make the best decisions. And some of the decisions we made were sometimes very self-involved, very self-interested.
Wait, let's put others up against Richard Nixon and Lyndon B. Johnson. We did pretty goddamn good.
I'm not going to take no flagellation on this.
Everything
has to be placed in its proper context. You know, and Jerry Rubin had to argue to get Lennon to come here. It wasn't like John just said, "Oh yeah, what a cool idea. I'm going to go and do it."
But he did come.
So what?
Jerry Rubin was one of the biggest egomaniacs of all time.
Hey,
but he came here and he got John Lennon to come here.
Yeah, all right. You want to talk about what happened with the money after the concert?
No.
Yeah.
No.
What happened?
Well, we don't
you got an accounting?
There wasn't any.
There wasn't any money.
Exactly.
We charged $3, man. The stupidest thing I ever did in my life.
Yeah, that's what Pete Andrews said last night. He tried to get you to charge more.
They all tried to get me, the Central Committee tried to get me.
And it went on for 12 hours, right?
It's got to stay at $3.
So how much is that an hour?
If we would have charged $10, our whole lives would have been different. We might have took over the country. Well, because my brother David, who ran our organization as the chief of staff, every day he kept this ragtag bunch of hippies together. 35 people were fed, housed, clothes, they got a place to drive where they could drive to the gig or whatever. But it was hard every day, it was uphill. We didn't have no money.
Which is why you had to ask for $5 to
right.
buy a pair of jeans.
Right.
It wasn't any money.
Right.
Yeah, I don't agree with you. I think it was mostly altruistic, but, you know, human beings are emotional creatures.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people, of course, were acting on emotions, and sometimes that led to, you know, beautiful experiments, and sometimes it led to strife and, you know, blows to people's egos and, you know, bad decisions. But that'll happen anywhere. That'll happen anywhere. But the sense of possibility and experimentation, the early days of it anyway, the optimism was incredibly infectious. And then, of course, you know, Jeannie talks about how when it first started, they were the odd hippie walking down the street, and then it was everybody. You know, once the Beatles went and grew their hair long, and all the music was celebrating that culture, the amount of unity among young people at that time is really hard to imagine now.
Young people with long hair.
And that's why when in Ann Arbor, you know, after the Supreme Court lowered the voting age to 18 and said students could vote here where they went to school, we looked at each other and said, oh my goodness, we can take over the city because there's a majority of people who think like we do here and who have the same interests. And so we did. And it was a shock. I mean, we didn't really think we'd succeed, but we did, and you couldn't imagine that happening now. And that...
Sure you could.
It's hard for
people
me.
People can do whatever they want at any time.
But that led to a counter-reaction.
Excuse
me. And I think one of the untold parts of this story is... The authorities moved against this in some very obvious ways, but also in some subtler ways. And we don't know the whole story yet of how they helped turn the community against what we were doing. But we also helped turn the community against what we were doing. We made some stupid errors. There's a letter in the exhibit at the library that I think I'd never seen before. I think, Pine, you haven't even seen it yet. It's a letter from J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, to President Ford, warning him about the White Panther Party and how they were armed and dangerous and organizing young people through music and were talking about the end of money.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Still a good idea.
You know. So it was frightening to them. I mean, you know, we know the story how they moved against Lennon and they started deportation proceedings against him to shut down what they were all planning to do, which, you know, would have been, I mean, you can't imagine back then. There was, when John Lennon said the Beatles are bigger than Jesus, he was right. You know, there had never been a bigger myth. The potency of that myth was unbelievable. And so when we announced on the radio that after the breakup of the Beatles, John Lennon was coming to Ann Arbor. I mean, nothing bigger had ever happened here. And look at the amount of political pressure that translated into that the Supreme Court that wouldn't give this guy bond on appeal after 2.5 years, including a lot of solitary confinement, on a constitutional challenge to the marijuana laws, saying that they were as addictive as heroin. And 3 days after this concert, they let him out on bond. I went, well, oh my God, rock and roll. Well,
the other half of that was that we forced the legislature to pass the law, which was the basis on which they gave me the bond.
That's right.
So there, John Lennon mottled himself for nothing.
Why do you say that?
Well, he...
That was years later.
No, he got stopped for doing what he wants to do by the government on account of playing this concert for
That's true.
Okay? They shut him up. They were trying to deport him and Yoko back to England based on John Lennon's marijuana conviction in London years ago, and they were going to use that conviction to deport John and Yoko, and they did. And they got a stay of execution in America, provided they would not engage in any more political activities. And that right there was a sentence for a working class hero.
And that was because of his relationship with the concert.
Yeah, no question.
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean,
otherwise
it was a very odd thing.
Here's
something he had to be talking
to
doing that ends up turning, you know, biting him in the ass, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, they muzzled him.
Welcome
and there's a great movie about it called The United States versus John Lennon that I highly recommend. It focuses a lot on December 10th, and it's beautifully done. The real movie of that concert, 10 for 2, has never been released. I think you can see parts of it on YouTube now illicitly, but it's a great, great movie. It's probably one of the classic music political movies ever made, and Yoko to this day will not let it come out, which is very surprising. Well, she won't. I've asked her. She will not let it come out.
And you know why?
No.
I think probably the promise they made to the government not to do anything political might have included showing that movie. Because it's very political.
Not in perpetuity.
Well, they do things in perpetuity.
Something. Richard Nixon is enough to get your nuts up.
They wouldn't give me my passport only like 3 years, 4 years ago.
Is that right?
Yeah, they called me from Washington to tell me they were not going to give me my passport. And I'm like, why? You know, this is, you know, and it was a very nice lady. We had long conversations for weeks, me trying to figure out. She knew everything about me.
Because of your trip to Vietnam?
No, she would never say. She just kept saying, well, what have you done? And I kept saying, I haven't done anything for a long time. and then I got on the phone with somebody. I knew somebody who knew somebody in the ACLU. So I got on the phone, and I had mentioned to somebody on the phone that I was in touch with somebody from the ACLU. The next week, I got this big envelope with my little passport in the corner, and they sent me my passport. Good. So it is, they still... Don't underestimate their rabidness.
I have to dispel the conspiracy theories, but I go back and forth all the time between my passport. My passport's got so many stamps on it, it ain't even funny.
Yeah.
And last Friday, for the first time in I don't know when, I landed in Detroit, and I went up and handed my thing in and my little thing about what you were doing. I said, yeah, go on, have a good time. They didn't even look at my bags.
That's great.
If they were going to get somebody, it would be Sinclair coming to the 40th anniversary. I don't know.
It's arbitrary.
I think our problems with the government go way beyond anything that might do to any one of us. It's just this whole culture that they've created here of ugliness and hatred and no heart and not giving people, taking their pensions, and Jesus Christ, wake up, you know, they've ruined this country. It's not the place that we grew up in. I hope they change it back. You get the nerve of a guy like Newt Gingrich to step up there and run for president. Jesus, talk about why don't they shoot? No, never mind, I didn't say that. But he is the guy who ruined the government in our country in the 90s, if you remember. They try to erase all these things like they've erased hippies and the Black Panthers. And that's why I love what they're doing here, Amy, and they're doing with the library, because to keep this alive like this and to be here in the flesh with these people in front of you and to talk, this is beautiful. This is what America's all about. Remembering our past, our achievements, our problems, the things we did to get out of them, how we triumphed over adversity. We're sharing all this today. This is beautiful, but when you leave here today, when I go back to Detroit, where I stay at right now, there won't be anything like this, you know. I mean, it's the world there, it's a whole different world. They don't even have computers. You think I'm joking? They got a whole different world in Detroit. It's black people without any money. They've been there like that for 40 years. So the stuff they noticed in 2008 about the General Motors and all that, that happened in Detroit 40 years ago. They have three generations of people in Detroit who don't even know what a job is.
John,
they don't know anybody with a job.
John, so then what's the message and what's the legacy? What do you bring from this to that environment?
Well, I bring my ass. I bring it from here to there where I stay at. I don't have a car.
That's a nice thing to say.
I don't have heat where I'm staying. It's fucking freezing. You know, I can't go anywhere because there's no transportation. I mean, I live in Amsterdam. You know, if you want to go somewhere, you walk down, the tram comes by, and you get on, it takes you where you're going. You don't even have to think about it because they thought about it. There's intelligence at work in their planning of the daily life. But in Detroit, it's like it's just been stripped, you know. I don't know. I'm just saying this because y'all are here in Ann Arbor, and we're all here with our little white faces smiling and having a great time and everything. But man, in Detroit, it's fucked.
But what do we do about the Detroit?
I don't know what you do. I fled. I fled Detroit 20 years ago. I moved to New Orleans and I lived there 12 years. I couldn't make a living and I said, if I'm going to starve here, I was pretty well known. I had the most popular radio show in New Orleans for 5 years, but I couldn't pay my rent. I thought, if I'm going to starve here, I'm going to try to starve in Amsterdam. I like it. And so I did. I starved for about 3 years, and now I got my sponsors, a series seed company.
David,
I got my own brand of seeds just released, John Sinclair Seeds. Buy some today.
David, you're involved in things like moveon.org, so I mean, you know, what's your perspective? I mean, is fleeing the answer?
No. Propaganda has really triumphed. I mean, it's really remarkable. This is the richest country on earth and the richest country that has ever existed in the history of the world, with the richest people in it who have ever existed in the history of the world. And they have convinced this country that it's broke.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know, talk about bait and switch. So the people who took all the money have convinced everybody that they don't have any. And they've...
Well, it's like Corzine.
And they've
I don't know what happened to it.
Now, John, you've mellowed. You're ready to let other people talk a little bit. Okay.
They're doing this in my name. I figure I got free reign.
No.
You don't like it, throw me out. That's not the John Sinclair Freedom Rally without Sinclair.
That's like a...
That's what I had to tell him last night when we were having our joints in the dressing room at the Ark. You know, well, it's the John Sinclair Freedom Rally. What do you think it was about?
So at any rate, this is why I think really we need a new underground press. The corporatization of the mainstream media basically leaves messages like the one I just said. It's very hard to find, and this is why I'm so excited about these Occupy Wall Street kids, because, you know, talk about an incredible accomplishment. You go out on the street pretty much anywhere in America now and ask people, 99 versus 1, what does it mean? They'll all know. They can all tell you. That happened in 6 weeks. That's incredible. And I know that those kids are going to build on this. They're very determined. No, I did not do that. A marketing guy did it, who runs this newspaper in Canada called Adbusters. He did it.
Oh, Adbusters.
But can you talk a little bit of your accomplishments that everybody knows about, but they don't know you did it?
I don't know about that, but you can go to our website and see it. But to me, the issue now is for everybody to take this up. We are not broke. You know, this country used to spend, you talk about like what you're talking about, John, in Detroit. This country used to spend twice as much of its GDP on infrastructure, on roads, on rails, on education, on public housing, than it does now. And all the rest of that money has gone not only to the top 1%, but the top 10th of 1%.
Right.
One out of every $4 in this economy goes to the top 1% who own 40% of the wealth. Now, in Europe, they still invest in public goods and public infrastructure, and they have a much better quality of life. And yet, you talk to American politicians, and they're like, well, you don't want to be like Europe. Please. So I think that you know, we need to join with these kids in making this the issue, because it's the only issue. This country is not broke. We have all the money we need to solve all our problems. We have all the technology we need to save the atmosphere from destruction. And we're in this like giant Shakespearean tragedy right now, where a very, very few number of families and companies, it's almost like a banana republic, are in the way of this great amount of progress we can make. And that sounds simplistic and crazy, but it's true.
Bobby Seale said at the John Sinclair Freedom Rally, the only solution is a people's humane revolution.
The only solution to pollution.
Oh, yeah.
Well, which leads to the issue of leadership. I mean, like most people, I'm very enthusiastic about Occupy and have followed it somewhat closely. But eventually, it's going to come down to leadership, because in order for there to be a revolution, there must be a revolutionary party. There must be a group of dedicated people who make this analysis about the 1%. But then you always, the next step after the analysis is to create the machinery. By machinery, I mean the political machinery or a party by which people can put this analysis to use. Because there's tons of students, political science students, economy students here at this university who can make that same analysis. So there needs to be this machinery of taking this stuff and then addressing the issue. I have been advocating and speaking for a long time about a third party, a socialist party. For one thing, I believe we need to get away from that tremendous fear and brainwashing that's been going on since the 40s about the word socialism. I mean, Jesus Christ is so simple. We can see the collapse around us. I mean, this was all written by Marx in 1848, that capital would continue to be condensed and consolidated in the hands of the smaller and smaller group of people. That's the Communist Manifesto. It's right in there. And this is what we're seeing now. So I think that there needs to be a massive re-education, a massive counter brainwashing. Most of Americans suffer from that Stockholm system or Stockholm syndrome, where they identify with their oppressor. It takes a lot of young people and some of us who have been there to articulate this stuff and see that it happens, because the anarchists, on the one hand, at a revolutionary stage, the anarchists are our closest allies. But then when you're trying to build, the anarchists are just in the way, just like Fenton so articulately mentioned, you know.
There needs to be leadership, but it's things are different now.
Yeah.
You know, in the internet era, the crowd can organize itself. And sure, there have to be spokespeople and people have to articulate things, but you know, what we've seen in Egypt and Tunisia and here in this country, there's a new tool, and we're just at the very beginning.
It's not the same.
Of it. I think things are, the conditions for people to organize themselves are very different now. And I'm really quite optimistic it will happen. I'm sure there's not going to be a Vanguard leadership party, that's for sure.
No. Well, I think the great thing about this is that
we tried that.
Yeah, it was funny, Bruce, you telling this group of people, man, awesome people like Frank Bach and Peggy Taube, whoever else was on the Central Committee, We spent 18 million hours sitting up all night in a room arguing these things out amongst ourselves. 18 million hours. And then we'd sleep for 3 hours, and then we'd get up and go do all the stuff that we decided that we had to do the next day. But man, we debated this. We were the Central Committee of the Rainbow People's Party. We were serious as fucking cancer. And we were trying to take over Ann Arbor and build it into a revolutionary base area so you could show what you could do in one community and then you could replicate this in other places. We were serious. We dedicated our lives. We didn't do anything else. We got high. We fucked a lot. We listened to a lot of great music. That was all coming from within ourselves. But what we were dedicated to was trying to change this stuff.
And therein lies, you know, coming...
And it wasn't a vanguard party that was necessary.
You know, you were about trying to change it. You know, it was about trying to change. Wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see it as much as working within the system as overtly changing the system. And so, David, I think you're right. It was a beautiful quote. Like Pun said, I should write it down, and I did. You know, in the internet era, the crowd can organize itself. But organization is just one part of it, you know? Or you can organize, but then what do you do once you're organized? Do you work within the system, or do we have to radically change the system into something it isn't now?
Some people, all they can do is work within the system. That's fine. I mean, back in the day, down there at Wayne State, remember the young dude who took over the Wayne State newspaper? Johnson was his name?
John Watson.
John, I mean, some people, that's all they can do is work within the system. So it's not an either or. It's an everybody.
But can the system significantly be changed to affect the change in social structure?
Of course it can.
Sure.
I mean, we got the 18-year-old vote. We ended the war.
Throughout Nixon.
Throughout Nixon.
Hey, Jesus Christ, what do you want?
Look what Franklin Roosevelt did. That was within the system. That was pretty massive. You know,
they could do it now if they had a system. Our president wants to change some things within the system, and they don't have, they dismantled it. Sorry. We're going to take our ball and go home. You aren't going to have a government now, nigger. You ain't getting it. Sorry. It's over. We're going to make you look so bad that they're going to put you out of office.
There's somebody who wants to ask a question
over there. Sure. Question.
And can you tell us who you are?
Bob Alexander. Yeah. Human Rights Party.
Tremendous to see you all in one place, so healthy.
Good to see
and,
you.
And many of our friends are not here today. They've gone on.
Yeah.
One of the things I haven't heard you comment on so far is the organizing, the splendid organizing that's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio. I mean, in Wisconsin, they recalled several Republican state senators who all those state Senate Republicans, it's been there for at least four-year terms. Two of them had not had a Democratic opponent in 8 years. And we knocked off one of those, and we missed knocking off a second one by 1,000 votes. They are just organizing. In Ohio, the organizing is so, all the unions are working together, all the various groups are working together, and they put on the ballot the repeal of collective bargaining ban that the governor had put in there. They needed 300,000 signatures to put it on the ballot. They organized, they turned in 1.3 million signatures to put that on the ballot. And the largest number of votes Ohio's ever had, yes or no, on a ballot proposal was 1.9 million. And then last November, earlier, you know, a month ago, that thing won 4-1 or something like that. It was just phenomenal.
And but they're organizing for a Band-Aid. They're not organizing for socialism. They're organizing for more capitalism.
Your point is well taken.
Good.
But good start,
one of the things that you've alluded to, and I just...
You need one here against the Tough Nerd program about the emergency managers. I call them Nuff Turd, actually.
Let me just finish. The major thing we obtained in the late 60s, early 70s, was people's opposition to an imperialistic war. We're the first empire in history where the people finally convinced the powerful, no, you're going to stop. And I think you all were very, very instrumental in that. thank you for all that you did. And we need to look at what Ohio and Wisconsin's doing and others to organize here in Michigan. Some of us got some petitions for putting the repeal of the prohibition on marijuana on the ballot in January. We'll be out in the hall as you go out. Others of us have it's not a petition, it's just signing up to support our January petition drive. The second one is for John Conyers' bill for Medicare, improving and expanding Medicare for all in the United States. We need support to be active on that. We'll be out in the hall if you want to help with that. Thank you very much for being here.
Soon they'll be organizing against the emergency manager system.
Well, that,
and I suggest that you sign up.
That petition drive's going on.
What they want to do is go into Detroit.
We have another question here. Could you identify who you are, please?
Yes. Hello, I'm...
Yeah, I'm John Sinclair, I was just saying. Excuse me.
And that was Barbara. And I'm sorry, I'm... Mary and Sonny Sinclair. Thank you. And my question is actually directed towards my mother, Lenny Sinclair, just because I've heard her speak on it before. I'd like to ask if you could tell about how the artists, the graphic artists, and the musicians all work together to help free my father. Please.
Well, I don't know where to start. You know?
And all the politicians, the lawyers, the judges, I'm sorry.
Yes, before John Sinclair was freed by John Lennon, we started organizing against the marijuana laws way back after his second arrest, okay? We started an organization in 1965 called LIMA, which was started by Allen Ginsberg and some people in New York at Sanders in the late 50s or early 60s, LIMA stood for legalized marijuana. And so we started having lectures and educating people about the, you know, that marijuana was not narcotic like heroin and other narcotics. So it started way then. And then when we all got busted in 1967, we held off the trial for about 2 years by a whole number of lawyers helping us with pretrial motions, and one of them is sitting right over there, Buck Davis. We challenged the law on a number of grounds, that it's not a narcotic, that young people are excluded from the juries, and not, anyway, after 2.5 years, after the last of our motions was denied, there was a very short trial lasting 2 or 3 days, and originally John was charged with dispensing 2 marijuana cigarettes by giving 2 joints to a young lady who turned out to be an undercover police officer. Now, since John had already 2 prior convictions, he was facing 20 to life as a third offender. And
that was the penalty for sales and dispensing.
Possession was 10 years, and sales and dispensing was 20 to life, and that's what he was facing, 20 to life. And the judge, Colombo, on his own accord, reduced the charges to possession in order to get a conviction. Because if it was 20 to life, the jury might have found him not guilty, but since it was possession, the jury found him guilty, and immediately he got snatched up and put away without appeal bond. And Justin Ravis was our lawyer at the time, and he said, don't worry, we'll get him out on appeal Monday. Well, it took 2.5 years before they finally gave him appeal bond. You know, but during that whole time, we worked on all kinds of fronts. We lobbied the legislature, we lobbied the governor, we lobbied in the newspapers, we put 4-page ads in the Detroit Free Press. And there was one person who was very instrumental in helping us with Maury Gleicher. I don't know if anybody remembers. Maury Gleicher had the agency that was responsible for electing Coleman Young and John Conyers and all these black politicians to offices in Detroit. Well, Maury Gleicher took it upon himself and his firm to create a campaign that appealed to the so-called middle class, to the people, you know, the liberal white people. We had cocktail parties, we had demonstrations, we had in Lansing press conferences. Every time John had an appearance, there would be a whole bunch of white pantsers and other people coming to the courthouse. And so for 2.5 years, while he was in jail, all our energies were geared towards survival and getting our leader out of jail. When John Lennon came, it was like the cream of the top. It was like the last exclamation mark on a long struggle, and finally it worked. And
finally, the sheriff.
Door sprang open, you know.
I first met Lenny in New York at a gathering of music industry and publishing and media people who had gathered to talk about John's case and what people in New York could do about it. You probably don't even remember that, but that's the first time we met.
I got pictures.
So you do remember.
Well, I'd like to take off on what Lenny was talking about. Some of you probably know that Sinclair and I had a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court regarding wiretapping. Some of you probably also know that there was a point when I was charged, along with Sinclair, with a conspiracy to bomb and bombing the local Ann Arbor CIA office. Kind of tepid applause on that one. I was only charged. I've never admitted or denied doing it.
Well, they didn't really exist.
Let me make my point.
Don't take it to your grave.
They didn't really exist, did they?
No, right.
But how about the point that I think you were the first hippie to be placed on the FBI's 10
That's
most
what
wanted.
It says in the People's Almanac. Yeah. That's. But the point is,
you'd go into post offices and you'd see Punch's picture on the wall.
Yeah. You just steal them. You take them over.
Target practice.
Okay, then it is.
Jerry Lubin has a question.
The artist.
When we went to the Supreme Court with that wiretapping case, the remedy, first of all, in Detroit, Judge Damon Keith ruled in our favor. We argued that the wiretapping of me was illegal because they did not have a warrant. And of course, the government, now when I say the government, we're talking about Richard Nixon, John Mitchell, J. Edgar Hoover. They were saying, well, we don't need a warrant because Plamondon's a threat to national security, so I know we've heard that just recently. Well, Keith ruled that we can still go to trial, all you have to do is release the logs or release the wiretaps to the defendants. The government refused. They went to the Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. We won a 3-judge panel in Cincinnati. They ruled in our favor. Again, the remedy was release the logs or the wiretaps to the defendants and to their attorneys. Again, the government refused. They went to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court unanimously ruled in our favor that you needed a warrant to wiretap people. Again, the remedy was release the goddamn logs. The government would not. So the question arises, why wouldn't they release these logs? Here's my speculation. Before I went underground, like Lenny was talking about, Jeannie P and the whole party, everyone, all 35 of us were working tirelessly to get John or to get money for so we could give some money to the lawyers so they could have gas money to drive, whatever. We're just working. My job, at that time we had a plan where we were going to take out a full page ad in the Detroit Free Press. And this full page ad would be signed by significant, you know, Stevie Wonder and Bob Seger and various significant, not just artists and musicians, but political people, John Conyers, on and on. We were going to get this big signatures of all these prominent people in Michigan. So as part of my job trying to get those signatures, I called the Archbishop of Detroit. Hey, we got to sign this petition, because we're not saying that marijuana should be legal. All we're saying is that he has a right to appeal bond. I called my senator. At that time, it was Senator Griffin. Senator Griffin, you ought to sign this, because this is constitutional. This is a constitutional issue. He has a right to appeal bond, nonviolent crime, you know. So I was calling the mayor of Detroit, the mayor of Grand Rapids, like I said, the Archbishop, all these people. I think that's why they won't release the logs, because no one gives a shit if they wiretap this commie Pun Plamundon. But when they wiretap me, they're also wiretapping whoever I called. And now here's the bishop saying, what do you mean I'm on the wiretap? Or here's the senator. That's why I think, because it would those are the people that they don't want to offend. They don't care about offending people in this room.
Well, there's a sidebar to that, too.
Go to it.
It also finds out that in total violation of the law, they were wiretapping the deliberations of our defense team.
That's right.
Right.
While we were in court.
Right.
This was totally verboten.
Right.
But
and they couldn't let that be let on. They got busted for that in Chicago inadvertently.
Right.
And it was the biggest scandal of the whole Chicago 7 trial, that they were wiretapping the defense team while they were forming their defense strategy in their private legal room, you know.
They didn't even have to do that. They had somebody right there writing everything down. Here, when we had our central committee meetings where we discussed our strategy for getting John out of jail, we went to Delhi Park. We sat under a tree because we knew our house was bugged. But little did we know, about 25 years later, we find out there was an informer that was living with us who wrote everything.
That?
We don't know.
Oh.
All the names are blacked out in the police files.
Yeah.
So we don't know. I was telling the library today, somebody should go and find out who it was.
What, how, and why?
No, I think you could find it out. If somebody really looked into it, I think they could discover it.
Questions? Yes.
Yeah. No, but how about Jerry? Jerry's been waiting a long time.
Yeah.
Was it you? You were talking about John's motivation for coming to the concert.
You were talking about John's motivation for coming to the concert. But he also did a recording titled John Sinclair.
Oh, absolutely.
And the motivation, I think, is obvious for that and would apply to the other. Also, Jeannie, you talked about 50s to 60s. Well, I think it's exactly political. It's people wanting to be different from what was.
Right.
They couldn't stomach what was.
Right.
And they had to change. And that's where it began. And one more thing. All that you're talking about required a lot of press.
That's where you come in.
And I will take a little credit for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Working on the radio.
Yes, yes, yes.
And
yes.
whenever there was a rally, whether it be for John or let's say the mobilization committee against the war in Vietnam on the campus of Wayne State University, it was always announced or at least a couple of days ahead of time, and on that day, on WABX.
Yes.
And that, I think that was a part of the whole thing.
I got to jump in here because I got a beautiful story, and I've been wanting to tell Fenton how much I love and appreciate him. There was a time after the wiretap issue, John had been released from prison, and I had been released from prison. And a short time later, I know I should be telling this story with some shame, but I'm an unrepentant radical. But anyway, I got hooked up in a 30-pound marijuana deal up in Beulah, Michigan, and got arrested and was taken to court along with a local resident here who I don't have permission to use his name. But anyway, we went to trial up there on a big pot charge. And Fenton came up and lived in the defense house with us. And he had his little cassette recorder. God, he had that recorder everywhere. I've never seen him without it. In fact, this is the first time, but now he's got a phone, so it's... But he, after every day of court, Fenton would find somebody, a spectator or the defendant or the defendant's attorney, or try to get an interview with the prosecutor. And so he'd make this little tape on his cassette. And then we go back to the trial house. Fenton would take the phone off, take the mouthpiece off the phone. He'd hook these two little alligator clips up to the phone. He'd call this guy over here, Jerry Lubin, who was on the radio, WABX, and he'd say, hey, man, I got a feed from Plamondon's trial. And Lubin and his cohorts would run this live feed from Cadillac, where we were going to trial, about the latest on the Plamondon trial. It just blew me away that... One, that Fenton knew how to do this, and two,
he taught me.
And two, that someone had organized this enough to get a radio station to play our shit, and it just it
just one more thing. Everybody here should read Pun's book. It's a fabulous story of everything that we're talking about. And it's very well written. Read it. Get it.
Thank you.
Arwolf.
Hi. Yeah, well, yeah. Read Pun's book. Beautiful advice. Thanks, Jerry. I wanted to say that when the Freedom of Information Act was passed, I got a notice, and I actually got a file. And they told me that when at the age of 15, when I was attending tribal council meetings, that got me on their shit list. It was a great honor.
You belong there, Arwolf.
It was a great honor, yeah. But I wanted to say that...
You are a dedicated enemy of the state.
Yes, sir. You people were great role models.
Right.
And a role model, I mean that because a real role model can teach you by their actions what you ought to do and what maybe you ought not to do. And we all learn this way, correct? But I just wanted to thank you. You kept us off needle drugs. You kept us from taking pharmaceutical pills to get high. And most importantly, you showed us that we need to pay attention to African American culture and the culture that is not necessarily part of the dominant group.
Amen.
And that is your lasting legacy that's changed my life. So thank you. I love you. Thank you, each of you.
That was why I, you know, during my introduction, I said we didn't have to wait for the legends to come to town. They were already here. They really were. Another question here.
Hey, man. I was 19, going to Wayne State, met my wife there. My son is going there now. We're lifelong Detroiters. The place, from a Detroit point of view, Ann Arbor was Pepperland.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. And I'm proud of
that's why we moved here.
Yes, sir. I did. But I waited
we're
until...
We were tired of the blue meanies.
Yeah. Well, it took until 90 to do it. But I wanted to say that I listened to that concert live on WABX that night. Okay. Tape recorded it onto a reel. It's buried somewhere. Okay. But the idea that you guys were role models, okay, was true because you guys are only a few years older.
That was the idea, though.
Yeah. So, but I'm convinced that there are millions of people who heard that directly or indirectly that are my age, okay, barely, you know, upper middle age, right? And we are their upper middle age, okay, but we are a latent force.
You say I'm proud
okay.
of old people now.
Yeah, we're getting okay. But we are a latent force. We're aware of the Stockholm Syndrome, that everything that you guys are saying is right frickin' on, okay? And I want to see somehow, okay, for all of us to carry this on, tell the kids, find the venue, find the new ABX, whether it's viral on YouTube or whatever, okay, and kick some ass.
You know, I was trying to tell some kids about free concerts. We used to have free concerts every Sunday here in the parks in Ann Arbor. We fought with the police for years to get it established. And they're saying, wow, that's incredible. I said, well, no, you really just have to have a band that wants to play, and you have to have a space, and then you go down there and play. And then people come because they want to come to a free concert. It's not hard at all. You just have to overcome the brainwashing from the entertainment industry that there's no such thing as a free concert, unless it's sponsored by Shell Oil or somebody. You know? Even Shell Oil makes you pay for the Jazz and Heritage Festival.
I am Diane Ripley, and I lived at the Hill House from about 1973-74. I was not part of the earlier White Panther, but I am very curious as to how you did support yourself financially at that time, and what the day-to-day dynamics were.
It's a statute of limitations.
Yeah. So, how was your day determined? Who did what? How was it determined who did what? And what were your daily activities like?
When I got arrested, Buck Davis said, "Don't answer any of those kind of questions," and that was 40 years ago. But I'm still under that order, so.
That's an answer.
Why don't you tell him about my brother?
All right. I'll answer that a little bit.
Our hero.
Who are you?
Fuzzy. I'm Bacchus.
Fuzzy.
I don't have to do this emotionally at all. It would have been my poker face.
Fuzzy, the hero of the South University riots in 1969.
We all had our moments.
By the way,
we all had our moments during those times. You know, I'm here. And to answer that, David Sinclair was a tremendous role model for me. I was a young kid when I came to the scene. And I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was born and raised here. But I had run away. My family had moved away, and then I ran away from home, 15, 16. Was on the streets. And as this gentleman over here was talking about, there was all kinds of bad stuff going on the streets when you were that age. Okay, you didn't have enough perspective to really, you can look at it now and you can say, man, I would never have shot drugs, dude. That was so stupid. Well, I totally agree with you. You know, and anybody in their right mind would say that. But a lot of stuff was going on, and a lot of the young kids were getting into a lot of really bad stuff. And this group right up here saved my life. I'm going to talk about David. But David was a role model. We had a bunch of young guys that came in, young people, boys and girls. We came in, and David was a guy that he seemed like he did all the, he was not in the spotlight, but he wore the mantle of responsibility. David could always be counted on, no matter what had to be done. If there's a job, a dirty job that had to be done, David Sinclair would volunteer to do it. He would get it done. There was nothing that he couldn't do. I mean, he was always, he had the up, he was managing the up band. We were putting on concerts. He would do all the setup. They'd go in and take all the equipment up there for all these free concerts. They'd build the stages. He was in charge of all that stuff. He was in charge of making sure we had food in the house, right? He was in charge of making sure the vehicles operated, or we had vehicles. There was gas money. And you know what? I don't know how we paid for it. I know Lenny would wake me up we'd get up about 12 o'clock, because we always stayed up really late. So around noon, a bunch of us guys upstairs, they'd come kicking us and say, hey, David and these guys would go, hey, here, take these newspapers. We'd say, go sell some newspapers on the street. That's my reality. We did everything we could, from selling newspapers to whatever else we had, allies we might have had, financial allies, cultural allies. But
we used to call them righteous dope dealers.
Oh yeah, there was a lot. Well, there was a lot of pot smoking going on, and you know, that had to come from somewhere.
Greed.
But I just want to say, I got to tell you, in terms of role models, you guys really. I don't care what happened later. I don't care. The ups and downs of life and the ups and downs and all these years that have gone by, it doesn't mean shit to me. What means something to me is what you guys were to me. And you took a lot of us in, and you know, I got 6 kids, 3 grandkids, doing great. I got a best-selling book out, I'm an author. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, I don't think I would have lived beyond another 6 months if I hadn't met you.
Wow.
So I appreciate you very much. Thank you so much.
He's trouble.
Hello. First of all, I admire you guys greatly. Thank you. Thank you very much for everything you've done. Jonathan Dobson from Missoula, Montana. This pursuant to the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, if all the efforts that they do inside lead to nothing more than just creating more tyranny, oppression, and disparity and inequity, would you ever advocate any type of organized violent revolution against such tyranny and oppression? And at what point would you?
We did. Didn't work. They had much more guns in us. Yeah, I surrendered on that issue because there was no way to win.
You know, I think there's a lot more lessons in Martin Luther King and Gandhi than anything else for contemporary society.
Thank you.
Well, as a former Minister of Defense, you know how I got to be Minister of Defense? I was the only one who ever shot a gun before.
Diane, you had asked about
but how... But I agree with what was said earlier about I think it's fantasy, and I think for the first time in history, it's unnecessary violence. I think with the internet and with the technology and with the ability... I've always believed this, going way back to 68, that what was needed was the Cultural Revolution. And all the other revolutions around the world... They had the political revolution, then they had the cultural revolution, where they tried to change all these capitalists into socialists. What I'm saying is, because of the technology and because of our wealth as a nation, we have the ability to create the cultural revolution first and then adapt the political revolution to it. I know that's counter something. Anyway, go ahead. Jeannie, I'm sorry.
No, I was. Diane had asked about how we lived and how did we just. Did you guys want to hear about that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, so Lenny's real good at that.
We get a break.
No, you go take a break. Okay, we lived in. Go take a break.
I'm an addict.
I used to be. We lived in a huge, big house, right? You guys know the houses, right? They're still there. There was two of them. We had them, everybody had their own rooms, their couples had their own rooms, and we shared bathrooms. You took care of your own areas. We had, somebody built us an enormous long table. It was bigger than this one, wasn't it? It was huge, beautiful. Yeah, and we would sit around, and sometimes we would eat together, and sometimes we wouldn't. We had people who would make big things of food. Most of the time, we didn't have enough money. But you'd take care of your own place, your own area. And then we would wait until everything got so bad in the other areas. Somebody would clean it up, usually Lenny or the mother, right? The mother, right? Or some of us would help.
Con.
Basically. And how did we make our living? The bands, we had the MC5. This is the legal way what we can say. We had the bands, we had the up, we had people who would help us. And David was the rock of that. He was our financial manager, you know. He was the one who took care of the everyday, making sure we had enough money to pay the rent, and when we didn't, then he would negotiate, you know, and help. And we were always behind. We were always having trouble. But luckily, the people that owned the houses were enough, worked with us enough that we got through for a long time. So,
who did the cooking?
Frank. Frank Bach.
But there was a chart system.
We did that too.
When I got there, people had assigned roles, right?
That was later.
One of the people who lived in the commune was telling my wife last night that when I first got to Ann Arbor and I was assigned chores of cleaning up, I confessed to him that I had never cleaned before. And so we had this chart system, and it got very complicated, and there were no computers. You know, 35 people, who was supposed to do what on what day, and all their other responsibilities. And, you know, we were hippies, it's true, but we were very active activist engaged in the world organizing hippies, it's kind of, you know, a weird contradiction, but
hippies,
it's true.
Hippies aren't just the idiotic stoners that they've portrayed them to be.
Well, this, you know, this was partly the whole cause influence, but so, you know, I was assigned, for example, once a week, I had to take care of three children from about right after dinner and sleep with them and wake up in the morning with them and change their diapers and, you know, take care of them and soothe them. And I had never been around kids before. And that was an assignment once a week. You were in charge of the children, or you had to cook, or you had to watch the front desk, or, you know, you had to answer the telephone or clean up certain areas. It was very complicated. But for long periods of time, I'd have to say it mostly worked. You know, things were organized.
How did you get to do the things that you wanted to do in the work life part?
Well, you kind of just did them.
Let me explain how it started. How this communal child rearing business started is Frank had a baby, and when his wife split up from the commune or left, he became a single father. And at the same time, my husband was in jail, and I was a single mother with two small children. And so Frank was the leader of the Up and the lead singer. So they were an economic tool that brought in money into the commune. So Frank was faced with the dilemma most single parents are: do I go to work or do I take care of my child? And there was a little baby, so sometimes Frank would take Una in a little bassinet, put her under the stage while he's on stage playing this loud, loud rock and roll music. Well, after a while, we decided this isn't going to work, so we started having other people help us take care of the kids while he went to work, and then that translated also to helping with my kids, and then pretty soon we had a child, 2 hours. 2 hour increments, you take care of the kids, you take care of the cooking, you take care of the front office. We had a front office that we would answer the phones, and it was also a store. As what Diane was asking, how we supported ourselves, we were always making things. Mm-hmm. We were always making headbands or beads or candles or pillows or t-shirts or flags. We're always making things that we sold. In fact, we started a business called the Rainbow Trucking Company. We didn't have a truck, but we called it that. But the Rainbow Trucking Company was distributing things that we made to head shops in southeastern Michigan. Okay, so we would give, you know, newspapers, buttons, bumper stickers, free John Sinclair items. You know, we would distribute them to the people who sold them. That was the Rainbow Trucking Company. And always we had benefits. Bands always volunteered to help us out. Every band in town, you know, this is something that is, I think, unique to Detroit and Michigan, that the bands and their fans, and they're so united. I mean, what band has not played a benefit for some cause? You know, they all did, including Bob Seger and Mitch Ryder. In fact, Mitch Ryder played so many benefits that when he got out, when John got out of jail, you know, he became his manager. And so, you know, the people's music. And then, of course, we had Gary Grimshaw designing poster, beautiful poster and flyer, and working for the Ann Arbor Sun. That is just one of the most beautiful newspapers. And everybody can see that now, freeingjohnsinclair.org. By the Ann Arbor Public Library, digitized every issue of the Detroit Sun from those days. So if people are interested, they can follow week to week what was happening, and a lot of shit was happening every week. You know, you can tell by the ads and everything. And then when we got into community organizing, well, first, we had a massive voter registration drive. We were all deputized as voter registrars. In fact, David Fenton's picture up there at the library shows me as a voter registrar signing up John to vote, you know. And so when we registered enough people, we had, we had a powerful contingent, and the Human Rights Party, we, the Rainbow People's Party and the Human Rights Party kind of got together, and we elected two people to city council in 1973.
Two.
Anyway, by having three Democrats, two humans, and four Republicans, we ruled this town.
Yeah.
We ruled this town for 2 years with the golden age here. We had money for a daycare. We had money for the free school. We had money for the people's ballroom. We had money for the tribal council.
Free clinics.
The food court. We utopian society.
It was social democracy in Ann Arbor.
It was the golden age. And then after 2 years of that beautiful coalition, the Human Rights Party was infiltrated by some anarchists or infiltrators or government agents who split the party right in half. And the Republicans got back in office, and, except no matter what they tried, they still never got rid of the $5 marijuana fine. Well, they upped it to $50, but it's still only a misdemeanor.
I heard it was 25.
And the food co-op that we started back then, it's still going strong on 5th Street. Every time I come here, I try to go shopping.
Okay, we've got time for two last questions here. One over here and one.
I went on the first one.
My name's Jack Brisbane, and this question goes to Dick and Pun. This has to do with the Occupy Wall Street group. Do you think the Occupy Wall Street momentum can continue all into November of 2012 election?
Yeah, I do. I think it will. These kids aren't going away. They're not. And they're organizing online now, and they've already had a huge impact. Yeah, I think it's going to continue and grow. I have no doubt about it. And there's another
great
effort that's sort of merging with it, which is called the American Dream Movement, led by a very charismatic guy named Van Jones, and I think you'll be hearing a lot from them.
Everybody gets
their
own house.
I was encouraged recently when I heard that some of the Occupy people are getting involved in the anti-foreclosure medicine and this movement, as well as the one that interests me the most, which I have the most affinity with, is the squatters. People literally just finding an old house that's being foreclosed on and kicking in the door and setting up housekeeping. I mean, if you don't have nowhere to live and they got an empty house, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, just because winter is coming in some areas doesn't mean that the Occupy is going to end. It's manifesting itself in a lot of different ways now, which is one of the most beautiful things, I think, about it, that it's branching out into so many of those other areas. We have time for one last question.
My name is Odile Lugono-Heber. And I just wanted to know, at this time in Europe, we had May 68, we had Czechoslovakia, we had then China with Mao. How much were you influenced by international politics, or were you thinking about it? Did you discuss it? What place did it take in your movement? Thank you.
Well, Lenny's the European here.
I functioned not very well, but I still functioned as a so-called international news editor, which was really quite simple. I had the newspaper out of Cuba, the Grama. I had some socialist papers, and I had the, like Fenton was talking about, the Liberation News Service. And I would just clip or circle whatever, anything that had to do on the international scale with young people or people in motion against their oppression. So I didn't do it very well.
He did, though, because one of the things that would happen was he would bring things up, Pum would bring things up and tell us what was going on in different places, and we'd get excited. We were like, wow, look, this isn't just us. This is all over the world. Things are happening, and people are caring and trying to do things. So it was very inspiring, to be able to see.
So like I was saying, I did a real good job.
Okay.
Always quick on the uptake.
Hello, I'm Alan Haber, Students for a Democratic Society. So this is beautiful. You all are. What happened, and now here we are. And everybody here somewhere has been touched in this struggle. And this is really the time, and the people in the streets have seen it, that we need to take a next step. And one of those steps is really in thinking through what we have learned in these various experiences. Each of us has taken our life course. And as you may calculate, at least, this next spring will be the 50-year anniversary of the effort to make a political document, the Port Huron Statement. And that's an effort for that generation and everybody since to revisit what we thought then and look forward to what is needed in the situation we are in now. And what the Movement for Democratic Society, those trying to promote this rethinking, thinking together, as Isaiah once said, would be a good idea. If we think together and put our thoughts together, and maybe there are various thoughts. It's a manifesto we can maybe think as a manifesto. And there are many fists in this consciousness here. And I want to put out the plea that you each see yourself engaged in an effort now in the next months to think what you have been through and join in participating in this project of gathering our thoughts and trying to focus. By next spring to have a gathering, by next summer, the 50 years of Port Huron, to have a big convocation. Can we really think together and see what are our many fists? What have we learned? What have we distilled out of these agonies and ecstasies into a positive movement to transform this country? It is not a reform, it's a new system. People are saying it in the streets. We've discovered our dictator, like the Egyptians have, the Tunisians have, the Syrians have. Yeah, our dictator has its face in Wall Street, but it's in a system with its tentacles all through our lives. How do we expel this dictator out of our lives? And that's the challenge now. And this panel is a good start in our own rethinking where we're all at. So I wanted to say that, you know, we're seniors for a democratic society now. Okay, strugglers and seekers, survivors is one thing, but it's really, join up. We suffer for the lack of the continuity of the Rainbow People's Party, of the White Panther Party, of the Rainbow Party, of the Students for Democratic Society, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating. This continuity of the movement that was in your face, direct action, tell the truth. We need it again. We need to join up. Find your organization, get connected, and think together.
Okay, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you all very much for coming. A big hand for our panel. Thank you all for being a part of this. Be sure to check it out at freeingjohnsonclaire.org.
We elect Obama.